the next page, top paragraph.
I think he said constituents.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I didn't know that constituents had anything to do with water when you talked about
that. That constitute part of the water.
Okay,
some of them vote.
That's just a suggestion. I mean, on the next page, we're talking about arsenic, top paragraph. I know somebody else has some other. You circulated another page that has Commissioner Pinkel's comments in red. Those are going to be part of the minutes as well. Okay. About the line about the middle, it says arsenic is a natural occurring substance and is normally at a very consistent level. You'd probably say consistently low level. There. Because it is, right?
Depends where the water is from. Usually, his point was it doesn't usually, it doesn't go typically up and down and up and down. It can be consistently high, or it can be consistently low, but it's typically very consistent.
Okay. The third paragraph on the same page, where we were talking, Commissioner Hetherington was asking questions about the new ag testing that's being done. Mr. Packard will follow up. Did he say when he was going to follow up? Should we put that in there? No.
I thought I could get her the results, and he didn't say when, so
I put it on my calendar for 2 months.
Okay. Okay. Under public comment, last line on that page in public comment, threshold for acute effects is one part per million. I mean, one in a million.
One in a million has acute effects, I believe. One in a million persons.
Is that what that is?
I think what he was saying was that they set standards so that no more than one in a million would have a...
an undesirable effect, whatever is in the water, or a toxic effect.
Yes.
Okay. I'm glad I'm asking these questions. That was all my questions.
Are there any other additions or corrections or questions about the minutes? Oh, Commissioner Pinkel.
Okay?
Yes.
You hear me now? I wanted to just indicate that there are some changes in the minutes on page 2 on the that everyone receives. It's in red, and it refers to the arsenic problem and also fluoride problem.
Okay, so we all have the second page with Dr. Pinkel's additional comments, and they are now part of the minutes. Any other comments about the minutes? Move for approval of the minutes.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved as amended. Okay, it's a public comment period now. Anybody who wishes to speak on a subject that is not on our agenda may approach the podium and please state your name for the record.
I am Eric Greening from Atascadero. I'm one of your constituents, and I'm 70% water. Happy Guadalupe Day, and I hope you have a happy solstice, happy Hanukkah, and Merry Christmas, New Year's, and everything else that might be meaningful to any of you. I just wanted to bring to your attention that as we're planning for the coming year, one document that might not automatically come your way probably should. That is the parks and recreation element of our general plan. And the reason it should come your way is because your concern with obesity and general fitness issues absolutely requires your input on a document that essentially will set the pattern for how and where outdoor recreation will be available to citizens of this county, and particularly in the unincorporated areas. As we know, as the automobile goes faster and faster in greater and greater numbers, fewer and fewer young people are getting to school under their own steam, and often circulation in their own communities is impacted in many ways to the detriment of pedestrians and bicyclists. And while you don't have any real say over such documents as the regional transportation plan, because they are the purview of the Council of Governments rather than the Board of Supervisors, the parks and recreation element is directly a county document. And I would suggest that you request that it come your way, just so that you have a chance to weigh in on these opportunities for vital outdoor exercise. And even some indoor exercise might slip into it here and there. But just have a chance to weigh in from the health point of view, because I think it is a point of view that definitely needs to be heard. We're hearing concern from some private property rights advocates that just pedestrian use of public rights of way adjacent to their properties is somehow scary. So there is a kind of a battle shaping up over this document that I don't think is necessary. There's no intent to condemn private property for trails or walkways. The intent simply is to clarify the use of existing public rights of way throughout the county. And I think people with an interest in health ought to have an interest in making sure that people of all modes of transportation include those that involve exercise and can be pursued countywide. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Greening. Is there anyone else? Mr. Arnold, would you state your name, please?
Yes. My name is Jesse Arnold. Thank you, Chairman Anz and members of the commission. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria, and I just want to read a brief letter that I turned in and make a few comments about it. It's on the subject of genetic engineering. Dear Chairman Enns, I'm looking for a study of 5 years duration or more that is not financed by the biotech industry that shows that BT corn or any other genetically engineered crop is safe for human consumption or safe for the environment. Can you help? Thank you. And then I put a PS. I hope the GMO task force can find some long-term studies on the safety of genetically engineered crops. My request is that whatever studies are cited in the report, we will be told who funded the study and how long it lasted. I have not studied this extensively, but I've looked at a few reports, and I've been struck by how short in duration studies have been. So I think there's a big question mark there for me. So as I say, I hope the GMO task force will look at as hard as it can for all the information and tell us how long this study, if any study they cite, how long it lasted, and who paid for it. I am concerned here because the supposition is that they're safe because they've been passed by the government. But what I've read is that the companies do the work, and much of it is kept to themselves because they say it's proprietary and it's patented and they don't want people knowing what they know. So I would be very interested if this task force can come up with any studies done by any branch of the government that would speak to the issue of safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Is there anybody else?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mary Miller, and I am the new EOC Safety Net Healthcare Advocate and Ombudsman's Person. And I just want to introduce myself, and I want to inform everyone that the program is up and running. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else for public comment? Okay. The next item on our agenda is the GMO Task Force new membership recommendations from the committee. Just a little background. There were to be three new positions, actually two new positions and a person to fill one that was more or less vacant, that being the public health department person, and also a bioethicist and a
biomedical
researcher. Got it. Okay. So the committee did meet. There were applications accepted. The committee has met. The committee was composed of Dr. Pinkel, Commissioner Pinkel, Commissioner Jan Hicks, and who else was on that?
Me, Commissioner O'Dell.
Oh, sorry, David. Commissioner O'Dell. Excuse me. So they have apparently found some candidates that are appropriate to be appointed, and I'll turn it over to Commissioner Pinkel this time.
There were five applications, and we reviewed them. And first, the application for a representative of public health, and we have chosen Michelle Shoresman. She has a master's in the field of public health from the University of Washington and is currently employed in our county health department. And she feels that there are pros and cons to the use of GMOs, and she wants to share with the other members of the task force the information that she has and make her contribution. And we felt that she was an appropriate member to cover the area of our public health. The second position, that of the bioethicist, we had an application from Dr. Ralph A. Jacobson. He is a professor in our Department of Biochemistry at Cal Poly. He received a doctorate in biochemistry in 1966 at Cornell University, and he has been teaching here at Cal Poly since 1968. In the last 15 years, he has become interested in the field of bioethics, and he has been teaching for many years our standard course in bioethics for our science students and math students at Cal Poly. And he had, I think, excellent qualification both in the science of GMO and also ethics and its application to that science. So we suggest him as our new member, as our bioethicist. And then our third candidate is in biomedical research. This was a little more difficult because we have no medical school in the city and no research institutes as such. But we do have the application of Dr. Jer DeZariga. Dr. DeZariga received the MD degree at Baylor College of Medicine and in the year 1974. He then came out to California as a resident in obstetrics and gynecology at LA County General Hospital and USC. In 1978, he went to the NIH in Washington, and he had a fellowship in reproductive medicine. He returned to USC in the year 1980 as assistant professor. and continued his research in reproductive biology and endocrinology. He also did research in endometriosis and in wound healing, which are his main interests at this time. He has over 200 publications in the literature, in the scientific literature, in those fields. He has written 5 books in his field and 46 book chapters. At this time, he's a full professor of obstetrics and of gynecology at USC Medical School. And he's also director of the Livingston Laboratory for Reproductive Biology at USC. He lives here in town, however, and he has some interest here in biotechnology, in testing some new substances for wound healing. So we suggest that he's well qualified in the field of biomedical research.
Yeah, and there was one other, Dr. Winkle, that we recommend that all members of the task force be voting members, including the public health and ag person.
So we submit those names then for your approval, for the approval of the Health Commission.
Commissioner Heatherington. Last year when the original task force was appointed, I wasn't here, so I don't remember what the procedure was. I think we had an email about this. I think we've simply accepted the members that were recommended by the committee, and I don't think there's anything more formal that we have to do about that. Did you vote? Oh, okay, well, then let's have a vote. That sounds like a good idea.
I'll make a motion to approve the recommendation of Mr. Finkel and staff.
Okay, there's a motion on the floor. Second. Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Heatherington. Any other discussion on the motion? Then I think a simple voice vote will be sufficient. All those in favor of the motion to accept the members that have been recommended by the committee for the GMO task force?
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Oh, okay. Unanimous approval of the new members. And I, speaking for the task force, will be looking forward to seeing them. And I personally want to thank Dr. Pinkel. He beat the bushes and found the biomedical researcher. Not an easy job. And I know it took you a little while to persuade this gentleman to become interested in our group. So we really, really appreciate your help in that, Dr. Pinkel.
Thank you.
I don't right offhand recall the next meeting of the GMO Task Force. Do you recall, Jean, when it is? It's at the beginning of January. And it will be held at the Public Health Department, and it will be posted outside the Public Health Department, the agenda, as well as if we can get it on the county website, on the Public Health website. And obviously we will notify the new members directly by telephone.
It should be on www.slopublichealth.org. That is our website. It should be on there. Under which, do we know which section, Jean?
It's under Health Commission agendas. There's a special one for GMO Task Force agendas.
GMO Task Force has grown in stature. Thank you very much, everybody. Okay, we can move on to, in December, we normally have nonprofits come and talk to us about their programs. It's been a tradition with the Health Commission, and we're very fortunate to have people here tonight that are going to talk about their organizations. And I was able to greet some of you as you came in today, but I don't know if everybody's here. So, but first on the agenda would be Edie Kahn from the AIDS Support Network. Welcome, Edie. Edie's the executive director, and thank you for being here.
There you go. That sounds good. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Health Commission for giving nonprofits like the ASN the opportunity to be here and to let you and those watching know about what each of us can provide to the community. As it was said, my name is Edie Kahn, and I'm the executive director of the AIDS Support Network and Slow Hep C Project here in San Luis. And I'll give you a little history about us and what we do and some of the challenges that we've had in this last year. This San Luis Obispo County AIDS Support Network has been in existence for 21 years, serving the needs of people living with HIV disease and AIDS throughout our county. Over the years, the agency has grown considerably from its all-volunteer roots. Now, in addition to our invaluable volunteer team, we have staff who specialize in services such as health counseling, benefits counseling, housing services, and education and outreach. We assist over 130 clients with financial, emotional, and practical needs. For example, the ASN can assist with a client's insurance premium payment, with payments for lab work or medications that do not fall under an insurance plan. We can pay a client's light bill and their rent. We can make sure that a client's mental health counseling is paid for. We can refer to local physicians, provide meals from our food pantry, or a ride to the doctor's office through the good graces of a volunteer driver. We can make sure a client gets to the dentist and that his visit is paid for. The agency also owns and operates 12 units of housing in San Luis and partners with the Housing Authority on a lease buy-down plan for an additional 10 units as available. ASN works in our community also to educate about HIV prevention and risk reduction. Our education outreach coordinator has programs for high-risk groups, such as Fusion and Man-to-Man, which are two programs that build responsible community for gay men and normalize the practice of safer sex, or My Face, My Voice, a program of HIV-positive speakers that go out to talk predominantly to teens and young adults in the community about how their diagnosis has changed their lives and the lives of their families and friends, and most importantly, to educate them about how to know and avoid the risk factors for contracting HIV. Our education programs also provide informational forums for our clients on subjects as varying as back-to-work issues, facial wasting and body fat redistribution, methamphetamine use and HIV, and healthy eating. Since 2000, the AIDS Support Network has branched out and is now housing the Slow Hep C Project also. This program is patterned very much after our HIV services and provides services for people living with hepatitis C in our community. Hep C is a disease that is still very much under the radar in our country. It has been estimated that it is four times as prevalent as HIV in the United States. As soon as the Slow Hep C Project opened its doors in 2000, we realized that the estimation was fairly accurate. We have seen well over 400 clients in the past 4 years and are now maintaining an active client base of 300 for this program. We offer health and benefits counseling and our food pantry program and are able then to refer clients to other agencies and service providers throughout the county who can assist with housing, utilities, counseling, et cetera. We hope that in time our funding level will equal that of our HIV funding so that we can provide a fuller slate of services to these clients also. One of the things that we try to do throughout every year is strengthen our partnerships in the community. And since I'm here talking to the Health Commission, I thought I'd talk about our partnership with the community health centers, health clinics of the Central Coast. We're maintaining a presence in the SLO clinic by having our HIV health counselor assist the HIV treating physician in that clinic. ASN is working with CHC to help in further training their staff on the unique problems HIV and AIDS and Hep C presents in their patients. And CHC has been bringing their mobile van to our agency on a monthly basis for a series of Hep A and B vaccinations for our Hep C and our HIV clients, and other, and also for other at-risk community members. So this is a partnership that we continue to work on, and especially now that CHC is providing most of the clinic, is providing most of our clients with their clinic visits, we are really happy that we're enjoying a good and fruitful partnership with them. One of the challenges that we've had, especially in the last part of this year, is that along with many other agencies, we're facing the sort of specter of Medicare Part D. And what we've been doing over this last several months is we've been trying to educate ourselves, which is difficult enough, but then trying to educate our clients about what this means for them. Most of our clients, as you might be able to see on the chart, are people who are living close to the federal poverty level or below the federal poverty level and are dealing with Medicare and Medi-Cal. And so they are, a lot of our clients are dealing with how this Medicare Part D prescription benefit is going to affect them. Medication adherence is critical for both HIV positive and Hep C positive clients. And so making sure that their prescription programs are not going to be interrupted was very crucial for us. We're happy to say that at this point we're able also to fold in the AIDS Drug Assistance Program into our planning for people so that the AIDS drugs that are so costly and for most of our clients, they take many more than one of these medications, that this is also another safety net so that people aren't falling through the cracks when the Medicare Part D comes into effect in January. So we've been working hard in that vein, and we also have benefited from HICAP and from Area Agency on Aging's expertise, and thank them very much for that. As you can see also on the display, the benefits counseling, we've provided probably close to about 800 units of service for our clients, both Hep C and HIV clients throughout this year, units of service being an hour or more of service to talk just about this topic. So, and I know that this is also an opportunity for us to talk to the public about supporting our agencies. And I'd like to take the opportunity first to thank our community members for their ongoing support as volunteers and as donors. And this year we know it was particularly difficult for people who have given their time in huge efforts for hurricane relief and for tsunami relief and earthquake relief. Yet with all of that, people in our community still found time and money to give to all of our local nonprofits, including ASN and the Slow Hep C Project. And I just want people to know that all their donations are tremendously meaningful. $35, for example, means a counseling session for one of our clients. $50 is one food pantry meal a day for a month. $90 is 3 months of heat. $125 equals about a week's rent for someone. So all of these things are tremendously helpful for all of our clients, and we greatly appreciate that. If people are interested, they can visit our websites, www.asn.org or www.slohepc.org, for more information about our services and how people can help or access our services. So once again, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. Are there any questions for me? Right. Thank you, and happy holidays.
Thank you very much for being here. Next on the agenda was the Food Bank Coalition. And is this Carl Hansen?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm Carl Hansen.
Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting us, members of the Commission. I'm new on the job. This is exactly a week after I first started, so I hope I can answer all of your questions, but I'm returning to the area having been here in the 1980s and left just before the Food Bank Coalition was founded, but I was involved in the founding of Loaves and Fishes up in Paso Robles, so there's a kind of a continuing interest with me. The Food Bank was founded in 1988 and serves 175 agencies approximately in San Luis Obispo County. We have a new state-of-the-art warehouse in Paso Robles, and we're renting a facility in Oceano, which is a converted packing shed that is serving us well but doesn't meet our long-term goals for an adequate warehouse in the long run in the South County area. There are approximately 30,000 people who benefit from the work of the food bank in our area, which is to supply food to these agencies that then supply the food to the consumers and to the clients of our area. And I don't know if Edie actually, frankly, is a member of the one of our agencies, so I'm glad that you are, because her needs would be very typical of the kind of work that we do. Our resources are numerous, of course, direct donations of food and of money. Also, the government through FEMA, which is what we call shared maintenance, and we have other food that's donated through surplus organizations. And one of the newest ones is called Ag, Ag for the Hungry. Eggs Against Hunger, I'm sorry, which is located in Salinas and serves actually throughout the state, but their immediate concern is the Tri-County area of Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito County. And San Luis Obispo County is their next sphere of outreach, and we receive a lot of produce from them, which we, in a way, have to purchase through being members of Ag Against Hunger. So I'm particularly interested in your questions and your response, for giving me a little bit of a history if there are any issues or if there are any lingering concerns that I should know about from the public, as you may have heard from the public or as you are aware of previous, I hope that previous executive directors have been before you in years past. But if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to do my best to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions from any of the commissioners?
Yes, sir.
Is there a telephone number you can give so they can call and for donations?
Yes, and we also have a website, but the telephone number is probably best to call the Paso Robles office, which is 238-4664, and the website is slofoodbank.org, and so donations can be made either way. I don't have the mailing address with me. In fact, I don't even have any card with me yet, but either of those ways are good ways to donate. And we can take your credit card over the phone as well. I might just add, echoing again Edie's remarks, that there was a big concern in the food bank industry, so to speak, that whether, in fact, throughout the nonprofit community, whether or not people would have enough left after the tremendous outpouring of compassion after our own disasters here and throughout the world. And we did have a period where the supply of food really dried up, and our storage facility was very, very low. And since then, things have returned somewhat to normalcy in terms of the usual chain of supply. And besides that, the community of San Luis Obispo County has been very generous, and our efforts to appeal to funds have been responded to very well, and we are getting lots of donations from the community, in fact, better than last year with similar kinds of efforts to raise money and to receive donations to the food barrels that are distributed throughout the county. So we're very grateful to the community, grateful for your leadership on the commission, and anxious to be partners not only with our agencies, but with the larger picture of improving the health of the community and in all of its aspects. And we feel that by supplying food and giving some kind of security to families for food, that they know food is accessible, that they can use their limited resources for other things that provide for a quality of life that is at least minimal to provide for their needs. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Dr. Thomas, did you have a comment?
Well, welcome to the community.
Thank you.
The two questions. First, given the needs of the county, you said that, I thought I heard you said that you serve 30,000 people in the county per year. Did I make that up, or did I hear that?
No, that's an estimated figure through the agencies.
Right.
Through the agencies.
So 30,000 people are potentially hungry in San Luis Obispo County.
Yes, that would be true.
An overwhelming number, certainly a huge number. And if people want to, how do you recommend people help in the in this area? There's obviously a lot of ways people can help. Where are your biggest needs? Monetary donations or actual food donations? And I guess the other part of that is how much can you leverage with monetary donations?
Well, it's said in our literature that for every dollar that's given, 15 pounds of food is made available. And that's enough to supply a family for quite a few days, and for children for a week of food. And there are various ways that you can apply that, but it's multiplied many-fold for each dollar of donation. And we need both dollars food that doesn't perish, imperishable donations of food into the food barrels. Of course, there's always an awareness of the need during the holidays, but much of the food that's donated during the holidays is made available throughout the rest of the following year. So it's not something that's distributed right away necessarily, but is put so that it's available when people aren't quite so conscious of giving, perhaps, throughout the rest of the year.
So do you then, as you think about the impact of the money you're spending, it's always somehow, if you're a potential donor, you really can leverage a lot more if you get $10 than if somebody buys $10 worth of canned goods and puts them in a barrel.
Absolutely.
You can do amazing things with $10.
Yes, we do. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hansen. Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, Steve Willey, who is the volunteer coordinator.
Again, Steve Willey, volunteer coordinator from Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. And I'd like to thank you also for having us here this time of year for a couple of reasons. It's nice to be able to be noticed. And this time of year for us and for everyone else, I imagine, is a good time of year to remind people about all of the different services that are available in the county. And I think that people's awareness is probably heightened for lots of different reasons right now. Our Hospice of San Luis Obispo County is a volunteer-founded and largely volunteer-sustained agency. We've been in the community since 1977 and like to consider ourselves a safety net for a lot of people who are experiencing the pain of grief and loss, the bereavement issues that come around to all of us at some point in our lives. And also for people who may be experiencing for the first time and early on in their disease process and in their family life, issues confronting terminal illness and death and dying in our community. So what we do, the bulk of our programs are involved in counseling services and emotional support, and we accomplish that largely through individual counseling and also groups that we have on a number of issues, such as widowers support. We have suicide survivors groups. We have children's groups. We have issues that come into play that, for instance, we have a gay and lesbian and transgendered group that is periodically in place for people who have lost partners. Some of our groups aren't in process constantly, but do come and go. But the groups that stay in are permanently are widower support groups and general bereavement groups, so that we can work with people who have had losses. And as you all know, this time of year, sometimes losses come back to us. We have, you know, dealt with things. Maybe things have happened, you know, 20, 30, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. And during this time of year, it just seems like there's a lot of focus on family and a lot of focus on togetherness. And a lot of times that just triggers these loss experiences and loss feelings. And we're a place that you can go to process those experiences as they arise. And of course, that happens any time of the year when you hear a special song or anything like that might come along. So we do a lot of community education as well on these subjects. We have we pretty much go anywhere we're asked to do any kind of community education. We do a lot of that in this community. My particular program is the in-home volunteer program. We work with people who have terminal or life-threatening illnesses, providing them with rides to the doctor, emotional support. Most of what we do is caregiver respite, giving caregivers a little bit of opportunity to get away and you know, go to a movie or do some shopping or run some errands or just take some good quality time for themselves. We're just, as I say, we do a lot, because we're a volunteer hospice agency, we do work with oncologists a lot, doing transportation to chemotherapy appointments, radiation appointments, and we also have a wellness program that's involved with working with people who are coping with a terminal or life-threatening illness, no matter what stage they are in that process. A lot of people, it's not disease-specific. It does not have to be cancer. It can be many different things. But the thing that these people have in common are that they are all coping with some kind of quality of life issue in trying to, you know, trying to work through their illness and their disease process and doctor's appointments and all the stuff that comes along with that, family issues, family dynamics, things like that. Well, we like to be available for what the community needs, so we like to be responsive to things that, that the community asks of us. One example of that would be a program that I supervise also out at California Men's Colony, where we work with inmates and train them to be hospice volunteers or hospice-style volunteers for the inmates who are dying out in the institution, which also in turn helps the family members who are many times living in our community to cope with what's going on with their loved ones out there as well. So that's just one example of a community response. Somebody asked us for help, and we were able to give it to them. So we try to be as responsive as we can. We are community largely, almost entirely supported by community donations and community support as far as monetary donations are concerned. Various ways we get that, some through United Way, personal donations, fundraisers that we have, but we are primarily community-based as far as our support is concerned, so we like to be as responsive as we can to what the community asks of us. That's pretty much all I'm here to say today. I want to thank you again for having us and myself here tonight, and if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. I probably should also mention our website also, since that is kind of important these days, and that's www.hospiceslo.org. And for the community out there, you can also call us at 544-2266 and speak with a counselor if you need to do that or call us as far as referrals are concerned. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Commissioners, any questions? I just have one question. Do you have volunteers that would, say, go to a person has lost someone and they're at home and they're not able to travel out and participate in a group? Do you have volunteers that go to their home and help them?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We have a special training for that in our bereavement training program, which actually I think there's one coming up probably in March. But we do have volunteers that go in home and work with our clients that can't get out of the house, and there are quite a few of them actually throughout the county.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
And now Hospice Partners of the Central Coast. Janet Jeffrey is the administrator. Thank you for being here, Janet.
Thank you again this year for inviting us to tell the public about Hospice Partners of the Central Coast. My name is Janet Jeffrey, and I'm the administrator. I want to tell you a little bit about who Hospice Partners is, and I want to let the public know how we use donations throughout the course of this last year. It's our vision that of Hospice Partners that when residents of the region have questions, problems, or concerns surrounding end-of-life issues that they think of our agency, for our mission is to provide compassionate end-of-life care emphasizing choice, life, and dignity in partnership with patients, families, and the community. So who are we? Well, we're a nonprofit, state-licensed, Medicare and Medi-Cal certified hospice agency. We serve all of San Luis Obispo County and northern Santa Barbara County. Hospice Partners is an affiliate of the Wilshire Foundation, which is a nonprofit healthcare corporation. And I wanted to mention that because in light of a recent name change of another hospice organization that serves the area in the last month and some corresponding confusion, even as recently as this morning, I wanted to take the opportunity to say that while Hospice Partners of the Central Coast cooperates fully with other community service organizations in order to meet patients' needs, we are not affiliates of other organizations, just the Wilshire Foundation. So we're friendly and we're collegial, and we partner with them to provide care for a client, but we are not part of either Hospice of San Luis Obispo County or CHW's Marion Hospice, which is now doing business as Home Care Services of the Central Coast. terminally ill families and patients receive services in their own homes from us or their place of residence. We have a staff of 85 and 100-plus volunteer contingent. Our interdisciplinary team includes physicians, registered nurses, medical social workers, home health aides, spiritual counselors, bereavement counselors, pharmacists, dietitians, and specially trained volunteers. The teams provide physical care as well as emotional, spiritual, and grief counseling and practical support for patients and caregivers and bereavement care to family members for at least 13 months following the death of a client. While insurances are billed for services, we provide care to eligible patients regardless of their ability to pay and turned no one down again in 2005 for that reason. Our nurses and counselors are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Why are we dependent on contributions from the community? I want to give you some real-life situations, some of them rather unbelievable this year, and put it in context of as if you or a family was needing hospice care. If your mother needed pain medication to keep her comfortable so she can die in her own bed, which was her wish, and the cost of her medication was $37,000, we'll provide it. This woman's insurance eventually paid $6,000 of that bill, and she was on service for 5 weeks. If you needed a special bed that rents for $700 a month because it's too uncomfortable for you to be repositioned in a regular bed, we'll provide it. If your sister needs radiation therapy treatments to shrink the tumor in her chest so she can breathe easier, we'll authorize it. If your mother needs daily visits from a hospice RN and daily bath and personal care from a hospice home health aide, we will provide them. If you have questions, fears, or symptoms that need addressing in the middle of the night and you need a hospice RN or even a hospice physician to come to your house, they will go. And if you need an RN, spiritual counselor, or volunteer to stay with you while you care for your loved one the last night of his life, we'll provide them for you. And if your children, spouse, or parents need individual bereavement care for a year or more after you die, they will receive it. In 2005, we served an average of 158 patients each month. Our clinical staff made over 24,000 visits to patients in their homes or their places of residence. Our professional bereavement counselors, and there are only three of them, made approximately 5,000 contacts with grieving loved ones, telephone, individual, and home visits. Our volunteer hours numbered 5,445. Our drug costs were $390,000. And our unreimbursed and under-reimbursed care and services amounted to over $400,000, which was about 8.5% of our operating expenses. So I hope that gives you an idea of who we are and what we do every day. Hospice Partners realizes that we're just one of the many worthwhile nonprofit agencies in our area, and we gratefully appreciate everything that's sent our way. If you wish to contact us, we too have a website. It's hospicepartners.org. Or, of course, you can call us at 805-782-8608. And thank you very much again, and I hope you have happy holidays, all of you. And do you have any questions?
Any questions from the commissioners? No. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to introduce Karen Stenson from the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services of San Luis Obispo County.
Hi, thank you for having me here this year. I really appreciate your time. Dr. Thomas is sending around some handouts that I provided with some more information about our services. Those handouts are available from our office if anybody would like to get them. It's 785-0132. Again, my name is Karen Stenson. I've been the executive director of the Ombudsman Office for about 7 years now, and the average in the state is 2 years, so I've exceeded that. I guess now I have to go to 20 years because that's the next step. We've been in the Ombudsman business since 1978 when it was first started by acts of federal and state congresses. And the reason that the Ombudsman Program for Long-Term Care was established was because there was an awful lot of problems in care facilities in the early 70s and late 60s. And it was to provide nursing home residents with a voice and an opportunity to have somebody protecting them and making sure that the services that they needed to be have provided were actually given to them. There is an ombudsman program for long-term care in every state in the nation. In some areas, they're like us. It's a single-purpose nonprofit. In some areas, it's a governmental agency through the county. In smaller states, they have one office. It's their state ombudsman, and they go out to all the areas. However, those are the states that are about the size of our county, so they have a little easier at doing that. Here in California, we're part of the California Department of Aging. We're also part of the federal government, but we don't see them nearly as much as we see the state office. The services that are provided are for nursing homes and for folks who live in residential care facilities for the elderly here in California. Not all ombudsmen in every state goes to those facilities, but every ombudsman does go to the nursing homes. We provide advocacy to the residents and their family. For instance, I have a client who's in one of the nursing homes who's very competent, and he's having a lot of issues with staff not doing what he feels he needs to have done with his very complex medical care. So he calls me on a regular basis in spite of his blindness, and he'll ask me, okay, can they do this or can they do that? And we'll advise him on what, you know, he can do to advocate for himself, and we also make sure that he knows that we're there to help him if he's not successful. And so far, we've been able to empower him to really make sure that he's getting the care he needs. And when he does have more trouble than when he feels he can handle, we're right there. And we'll be at his bedside in just a few moments or hours, depending on what the need is, to make sure that his needs are met. We also do complaint investigations. So if a resident or their family feels that there's a problem, or if we notice a problem, we can investigate those complaints by accessing their medical records, by talking to the staff, and making sure that the problem is resolved. If it's not resolved, we can access other agencies like the licensing agencies to help make sure that the problem is fixed. However, we always recommend that families and residents talk to the staff in the facility first, because that's generally a much faster correction to a problem. You know, for instance, if a resident doesn't have water where they can reach it, waiting for the ombudsman or waiting for a licensing agency isn't maybe the best way to get that fixed. So we always recommend they start with the staff and go from there. In California, we're one of five states that also has the ombudsman program investigate cases of abuse in long-term care facilities. And in other states, they'd use adult protective services. But here we get that unfunded state mandate, which is why we're also a nonprofit, so we can fundraise to cover the cost of those services. And here in California, we've done quite a few facility or complaints of abuse investigation this last year, including 25 cases where the primary complaint was that resident-to-resident abuse, which is actually increasing quite a bit. The other primary cases that we're doing of abuse are families, where the family is taking the money of the resident or not providing the funds that are necessary for them. So both of those are rising problems that we're having in the county. We also do facility monitoring visits, and that's where we go into the facilities and make sure that things are being provided as sort of random visits. We don't announce them ahead of time, although, interestingly, a lot of the facilities will announce to their staff that we're there. They usually have one thing they call out when the ombudsman comes in, and we always figure it out pretty quick, but it's interesting. When we're doing those monitoring visits, and we did over 1,000 of those last year just in our county alone, because that's where we serve our clients, we're looking for health and safety issues. I have a residential facilities, a couple of them, that when folks with dementia are looking for light switches, they will at times pull the emergency fire alarms. If they're mounted in the same spot that one might expect or about the same level, and that's what they see, they don't. People with dementia don't always make the difference. And so we found several facilities that, to fix that problem, have covered them with duct tape. And as you can imagine, that's really not the way we would prefer that they correct the problem. So we'll get them in contact with the fire department to get that corrected. We also talk to the residents while we're doing those visits to make sure that they're receiving the services that they're provided or are required, and to educate them about what we can do to help them. We in California, another unfunded state mandate is that we witness people in nursing homes signing advanced health care directives, and I won't make anyone raise their hand and admit to not having one, but everybody in this room should have an advanced health care directive, and if you don't, we can provide those for free to anyone in the public with instructions on how to fill those out. And also, again, if they're in a nursing home, we must witness that signing. I'm not sure why we witness that one. I see an awful lot more problems with people having incompetent folks sign advanced health care directives or durable powers of attorney for asset so that they can then take the money. But we don't witness those, so I'm not – I don't know. The government sometimes makes their own decisions. And we also provide information on long-term care facilities and long-term care issues. So if families are looking for a facility, we have lists of facilities. We can talk about the complaints that we've received on facilities. And we have all the public licensing reports, so people can get a lot of information before they go out to find a care facility. Last year, almost 2,000 people moved into a care facility in our county alone. Not all of them stayed for very long, some for less than a week, some for a few months, and a few stayed for the entire year. But that's an awful lot of people who are our friends and our neighbors. And, you know, the reason that we're here is to make sure that they're getting the care they need. Most people don't get up in the morning and plan to move to a nursing home or to a residential facility. And it can be really shocking when it's a sudden stroke or an injury that puts a person there. You know, they lose an awful lot of control over their life. So having an ombudsman program, although most people can't even pronounce the name, really makes a difference in their lives, make sure that they're getting the care that they need. A couple projects we're working on right now is we're working with the County Public Health Department and the Office of Emergency Services to review disaster planning for facilities. A lot of people saw the Tribune article that said that they're kind of on their own. And before the Tribune article was even kind of hatched as an idea, we started working on that because we knew that there were problems. Before Katrina, there were problems, and it didn't get better after that brought a lot of the issues to light. So we're working to help educate the facilities and bring in some services so that they're not left alone in a disaster. And like others, including the AIDS Support Network, we're very concerned about Medicare Part D and making sure that our clients don't miss out on medications when the switch happens. As far as our needs go, like everybody, we can always use donations. But our biggest need is for volunteers. So anybody who is interested in being a volunteer and making a real difference for care facility residents, or who has loved ones in a facility far away and can't visit often, it's a great way to make a difference here locally. We have training starting in January, and our number again is 785-0132, but we don't have a website yet. So that's all I have. If there's any questions.
I just had one question. Did you mention how many staff and volunteers you have? You seem to have made a huge number of visits. And how many people actually do this?
I have two staff members, including myself. So I have one program assistant, and I have 17 volunteers. So they're really working hard.
Very impressive. Commissioners, any questions? Thank you very much for being here. Now, Michelle Vanderlyn from the Partners for Children and the Clinica de Tolosa. Welcome.
Carolyn is going to hand out some educational materials and also will help with the PowerPoint presentation. But thank you for the opportunity to present on our nonprofit Children's Dental Clinic. And on behalf of the Partnership for the Children Foundation of Slo County, I'm happy to update you on the oral health efforts of La Clinica de Tolosa. So that's where we're standing. There we go. First, I'd like to talk about our mission statement to help ensure access to dental care for children from underserved families in San Luis Obispo County. So we live by that mission on our forefront on a daily basis. It's all about the kids. We have mothers and caregivers and grandparents and foster mothers and fathers, and this is the positioning that we like to use for children that we see, and we see quite a few ages from 1 to 5. So we like to position them in the lap position to clean those teeth and also to view the teeth and see what kind of condition they're in. The the first responders are really at the forefront of oral health, and we'd like to get them in the picture a lot more. And the physician extenders, the people that see those children, the pediatricians first in their life, and we'd like to get that communication by maybe more community prevention programs with those individuals involved. This is what we see. This is a child with advanced decay, but it's called ECC, early childhood caries. And we would really like to prevent this, but we see this on a daily basis, and we also treat this on a daily basis. So this is what we're up against, and it does affect the general health of the child and the total well-being of the child as well. Again, we're seeing the child on the lap basis. The dentist can go ahead, or the dental provider can view the children at a very easy angle when they're seated right into the lap. So you can see how this little one is. If you make it a routine thing and very common, it's dental procedures become not as fearful. This procedure that we're doing here, there's many dental procedures. This one is just the fluoride varnish, which is a topical fluoride varnish that's applied to the teeth, and it does help those teeth sustain and become strong against decay. We like to see this, healthy kids and healthy smiles, the connection. We also promote cultural diversity, competency, and sensitivity. And we want to promote having fun, and that's a part of it. Tolosa has increased the scope of dental services, referral, and education, including IV sedation, that is offered on a monthly basis for children needing more comprehensive and complex full-mouth treatment. Also, the Tolosa dental team collect and they maintain data to track patient activity, providing the opportunity for ongoing assessment of dental and oral health services. Tolosa emphasizes improvement of the total health of the child. There's less absenteeism from school due to the dental treatment the child receives so that she can focus and concentrate because of being pain-free. Again, healthy mouth, healthy body. Tolosa's cumulative child visits from July 2003 to date are over 9,000. 100% more children have been seen since the opening of the clinic in July of 2003. From June 2004 to June 2005, there have been approximately 6,630 dental visits. June 2005 to the present, there have been 2,860. To prevent dental disease, interventions must be directed toward preschool children. In other words, 2 is too late and 5 is way too late for prevention of tooth decay, and you can see the forlorn looks. Tolosa promotes effective collaboration among the public, private, and community-based agencies to ensure maximum coordination of services, especially in the outreach, education, and linkage. We have two great programs with the dentists and dental hygienists through the Dental Society and also through the Dental Hygiene Society. So we're always looking for more volunteer programs. Tolosa Dental Team follows clinical guidelines that give clear direction regarding more efficient and accurate protocols to achieve improvement in patient care, as well as continually being culturally competent in the community. The Tolosa Dental Clinic is open 6 days per week with multiple dentists providing dental treatment, including oral health education and screenings provided to Head Start participants. Patient waiting list right now is currently 1 to 2 months. A real funny thing about this cartoon is some of our dentists saw this and they said, "We don't like our teeth are too sharp." First thing they zeroed in on. I thought, you know, you're right. Can you soften that up? We really actively seek grants and community support toward clinic sustainability, so we appreciate your time tonight, and we appreciate your inviting us to talk, and hopefully we'll see you in the future and can collaborate on some projects. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Pinkel.
Last month we spoke about fluoride in the water.
Yes.
Now, do you see a big difference between those children from this town, which does have fluoride in the water, and the other towns in this county in terms of the incidence of dental caries and all that?
Yes, clearly. And I appreciate your proponent of that fluoridation. It would be great to have it in the water. The fluoride varnish that I talked about is a topical substitute, but it's not systemic.
Yeah.
But thank you.
Yeah.
We see a clear difference.
Right. It would seem that that would be a good topic for this commission to get back into, water fluoridation in the future, and launch another campaign for the county and for the children of the county.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Pickle. All right. Lisa? Lisa Frazier is the executive director from SLOCAP. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for inviting me tonight. My name is Lisa Frazier. I am the director of the San Luis Obispo County Child Abuse Prevention Council. SLOCAP is our acronym, and I want to thank members of the commission for inviting me here tonight to talk about SLOCAP and what we do in the community. And I have, pardon? I thought I had a PowerPoint presentation, but I guess it's not on the CD like I thought. So I'll just do what I do and talk to you directly about what we do at SLOCAP. It was established in 1987 by a group of local physicians, law enforcement officers, social workers, and the community members who were concerned because of some incidences that were happening in the county where children were not getting the services they needed after some child abuse incidents that occurred in the 70s. SLOCAP was convened together so that they could address these issues in a responsive manner. And through the years, they have come together and developed all kinds of prevention education projects. And some of these projects that we bring into the county are the Talking About Touching Project, which is a curriculum designed by the Committee for Children, and that curriculum is used out in all our public schools. So about 1,800 or more kindergarten-age children, special needs children, first-grade children, second-grade children are presented the Talking About Touching curriculum, and they learn about personal safety, and their parents are also included in a parent education presentation. And those parents who are not able to attend because of work or other things that may keep a parent from attending the meeting, each parent receives 4 take-home letters that talks about the issue of children and their personal safety. And this project has been out in the county since 1998. It's been very successful, and we enjoy the support of the Preventive Health Grant that really helps us to keep that sustained out in the community. I have 3 educators that go out and present to all the schools in this county, and we enjoy being in about 85% of the public schools and also at Mission, Old Mission School here in San Luis Obispo. Other projects we do are the Baby Think It Over Doll Project, and this project has been in the county since 1998 also. This project is the computer dolls that simulate what an infant is like to care for, and it's in all our high schools and also in our middle school. We've just enjoyed a generous donation from the In-N-Out Burger Foundation. They are a strong supporter of child abuse prevention activities throughout the state, and we were able to upgrade all the equipment that we use for this project, and so the dolls are have the current computer technology. They're more lifelike, and they just completed a run with students in Atascadero High School. They're going to Paso Robles High School next week, and also Arroyo Grande High School, and several of our community schools. Over 650 students last year participated in this project, and they really get an idea of the consequences of parenting as a teenager, and they really get an opportunity to speak with their parents about the issues of caring for a child and how challenging that can be. Other projects we're involved with is the postpartum depression support line. This was a project brought to our attention about 8 years ago by public health nurses. They really saw a need to address the needs of women who may require some assistance once they've had a baby. And since then, we've had some incidences across the nation, plus some local incidences that have brought people's awareness up, and we enjoy support from the First Five Commission that allows us to produce excellent materials and resources that are circulated in all our hospitals, several of our private OB offices, and also the CHC clinics and a variety of other services all use our materials. And we generally get about 4 or 5 calls a month from family members, women themselves, the mothers of the grandmothers of these children, who are concerned about the depression that their mother or the new mother is experiencing. And we know how studies tell us that if a mother is not attaching to their baby in the early stages of life, how it really, it's not healthy for the baby's brain development, and how if they don't acquire any empathetic or attunement to their world. And so we feel really great that we'll be able to bring this type of project out into the county. And we've been doing that for about 8 years. Other projects we do are the mandated reporter training, and this is on the child abuse reporting law. And I'm very busy bringing that out into the community so we have a good understanding about what the child abuse law is, and that mandated reporters are required to report their suspicions of child abuse as well as any knowledge that they may have while they work. So that's been a very rewarding experience to be able to increase the understanding of our community about that law, and I'm happy and available to provide that training at any time for anybody if they want to call us at 543-6216. And the other projects that we're involved with involve bringing an understanding to our community about the needs of children who are perinatally exposed to alcohol and drugs and tobacco. I'm working alongside with Jan Campbell, our MCH director here for the Public Health Department, and she keeps me very busy. And we're really looking forward to reporting back to the Commission in the future about the new status of the work we're doing towards providing a collaborative system of care for children who are prenatally exposed to alcohol and drugs. And if you have any other further questions, I'm really want to thank you for inviting me tonight to come talk about SLOCAP and what we're doing. And our website, in case anybody's interested, is www.slocap.org. And I thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Warren.
Yes. Lisa, I know that Dr. Chasnoff was just recently here and spoke to a large community group at CSN, and it's my understanding that that's available for people to see on Charter.
Yeah, my understanding is that it actually was shown this weekend. I talked to a couple people today who brought it to my attention that it was on, and I imagine it should be continually running for maybe another couple weeks. I will have a copy of that tape given to me by AGP Video in the next week, and I'm happy to share that with anybody that would like to see that presentation. It's not a long presentation, but it really is very – Dr. Chasnoff does an excellent job of presenting the information and data about women who are using substances such as alcohol during their pregnancy, and some startling data is being collected, and we're very concerned about that as a community and how that affects the children, the unborn child.
Do you know if that's going to be available in the public library?
My understanding is that they will provide that. AGP Video does provide that at the public library for anybody to check out. Thank you for that question.
Chuck Pinko?
There have been very troubling stories about youngsters being abused or neglected because and not being ever brought to the attention of authorities because they were homeschooled and they did not encounter mandated reporters. Mm-hmm. Do you see this problem here? because homeschooling is increasing considerably.
Yes, it is.
It's becoming very popular. And to me, that is an unknown area. You don't know what's happening to those youngsters because apparently they're not really tracked by the school district either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question and a concern that we should look at a little closer, because there's no way I can give that information to you tonight about when a call comes in to CWS, whether they're homeschooled or not. But you're right. That would be great information to glean out to have a better understanding about that, whether a percentage of those calls that do come in to CWS are students or children who are being homeschooled. That would be something to look at a little closer, and I will definitely take that back to my board of directors and bring it to their attention.
It would seem to me that the school district, when they authorize homeschooling, should have some kind of follow-up provision, that there was a reporting to the school district as to how the child is doing, mm-hmm. not only with regard to their actual coursework, but also how they are being looked after and how they're behaving.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the challenges we have in the county, is to inform our educators, whether they're in a public school or a private school setting, about the mandated reporter law. There tends to be a lot of confusion about how to do that sometimes. Depending on your school district or your school, some teachers are trained to do this well and some aren't. They may understand that because they sign when they're hired a form that indicates that they understand that they are a mandated reporter, but the actual task of doing it is something that does fall to the side because there's a lack of confidence in knowing how to do that, or a lack of trust in the system that's there to intervene. So it's very inconsistent. My experience and out there teaches me that we have an understanding that there is a law to do that, but that a lot of our professionals may not know how to do that. And that's what the role I've been playing is, to try to bring that consciousness up a little bit. And it's definitely ongoing work. And it's like learning CPR. You forget. You forget how to fill out that report. You forget the phone number you're supposed to call. And but I can honestly say that in our county that we have a very good mandated reporting activity compared to other counties. And my understanding is the amount of calls that come into the CWS phone bank there is quite high compared to other counties.
I recall there were two young boys who were involved in the murder of an older man. And investigation, it was found they were very neglected and abused boys, and they were on homeschooling, and the school district had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
It would seem to me there's a hole in the system there that ought to be filled in.
And that's a good point, and I'm glad you're bringing it up, Commissioner, because it's something that if it's continuing to grow in frequency, because there are a lot more families that will choose to homeschool, and that's a right that they have, but at the same time, it's easy to hide abuse. It's easy to hide those kind of issues. What I can tell you about child abuse is that we tend to hear in the papers that it's, a sexual predator has abducted this child, and we get all upset, and we should be upset, but it's a very rare occurrence. We know that 80% of the time when children are neglected or abused, it's a family issue. We know that over half of the time when children are physically abused, it's done by women, not men. And we tend to think it's the Michael Jacksons or these horrible strangers that are out there doing that, but really this is a family issue. Did I answer your question?
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Is Charlotte Alexander here? No. Okay. Then our last speaker is Beth Robb, and she's from the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo. See if I can get that out. San Luis Obispo County. She's the volunteer coordinator, and I believe you have a little video for us to see.
Yeah, I sure do. I'll intro it real quick for you, just so you know what it is. My name is Beth Robb. I'm from the Women's Shelter Program in San Luis Obispo County, and we serve victims of domestic violence and their children. Domestic violence between husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriends, ex-spouses, same-sex relationships, and also the male can be the victim. We are seeing an increase in the men being the victim in the relationships. And so I'd like to thank you for having us here again to speak this December. And this video was made for us specifically by Jeff Lewis. And so what you're going to see is survivors from our county that came through our program, and also the actual safe house, and then some of the programs that we do run. So I'd like to just cue the video, see how quickly she gets it up here.
He grabbed me by my hair. He dragged me around the house. He kicked me, threw me in the closet. He threw me against the wall. He just did about every physical thing that you can think of, threatened to kill me.
He would get angry and he would strong arm me, you know. When I was pregnant, I remember, and I remember feeling so angry about that, and I got right back in his face, which I have found since then is not a good idea with someone that is in that state. He grabbed me by the front of my shirt and pushed me up against the wall and told me if I ever did anything like that again. And then I remember thinking that very night, I am either going to kill him or myself because I can't do this anymore.
Domestic violence is basically where one person uses power and control over another person and within an intimate relationship. And it can be physical, it can be sexual, it can be verbal. It can be financial. It can be any number of those things. It's not just one form. Often it's many of those combined.
I always wanted to get away. I would be looking out the window in the kitchen, doing my dishes, and I always wished that, you know, one day I would be away from there. But it was hard to think that, what was I going to do? I had three kids then. Where was I going to go? If I didn't understand the language, how was I to survive? He was the only one that could provide the house, the food, and everything else that the kids needed.
I did get the heads up at that point, thinking I really should get out of this. This is not a good relationship. But then I was becoming bigger and bigger and more pregnant. I was having problems with the pregnancy. And he appeared to really want this as well, so I hung in there.
One of the questions that we always get asked is, why doesn't she just leave? And we always like to say, why doesn't he not abuse? Why, it put it, because the responsibility is being put the wrong place. The responsibility is being put on the victim rather than the aggressor. But there are reasons why women don't leave, why it's very hard for them to leave. Sometimes it's economic. Sometimes it has to do with the children. That she may feel that he's actually a fairly good father, and the reality is that it's not a healthy place for kids. If they're experiencing and growing up in a family where there's domestic violence, the chance of them continuing those patterns into their adult life are much, much higher. But she may be, her self-esteem may have been eroded so much that she may not feel that she's able to make it on her own.
My self-esteem, it was just on the floor. I just did not have any self-esteem. I felt that there was no hope, that there was nobody that could listen to me, that could help me, that could support me. Because I thought, what do I do if I leave? Where am I going to go? The job that I finally got was, you know, the minimum wage. You need to have so much when you're going to rent a place. So I felt I have to stay here. I have to stay here for the kids. And that's what I was focusing most of it on, my kids, thinking I'm doing the best by staying there. But I know now that it was the worst thing that I was doing.
And I just remember walking through the door of the shelter and feeling a sense of relief I knew he wasn't going to be able to find me. I was hoping I would be able to step back and take a breath, but you're so traumatized. You don't know what you're doing at that point in time, and you just need guidance. So what they did was provide me with a safe place to be until I could get my act together and decide what I wanted to do next. I called the shelter, and they were there so fast. They were there so fast that I just grabbed the kids the way they were. I don't remember if they even had their shoes on, but I knew I didn't have much time.
We help over 900 women a year.
Hello, women's shelter.
And that's through hotline calls, through the shelter itself, through our counseling program, through our legal program, through our transitional housing, and the schools, our programs in the schools. But we're reaching over 900 people a year.
Okay, here we are at the Safe House. This is the actual confidential location that the women and their children come to when they're in need of a safe place to be. So here's the kitchen. And this is the dining area. Okay, this is one of our bedrooms. This would typically sleep a woman with maybe two or three children. And every room, when they come in, has a welcome bag. And in the welcome bag, it's just items that they may end up leaving without. It's standard, you know, shampoos, toothbrushes, combs, washcloths, soap. And if they have a child with them, there's also a welcome bag with stuffed animals and things for children like diapers. We kind of put them in as age appropriate. The curfew, we do have curfews depending on when they get off work. We like to know everybody's in and safe in the evening.
Once they've come into the shelter and they have food and clothing and those essential things, there's just a lot of other needs that they have. And so we've developed programs to address all of those needs. They can stay in the emergency shelter for up to 8 weeks, and while they're there, they get, as I said, emergency food, clothing, advocacy with social service agencies. They get counseling, both for the mothers and the children, and they get case management, which helps them find housing, helps them get jobs if they need a job, just get started back into a normal, violence-free life. They also need legal assistance. We also have an extensive counseling program so that they not only receive counseling while they're in the shelter, but they can continue with it afterwards. Because unfortunately, during that 8 weeks, you're dealing with real practical issues, but to deal with the effects of having been in a domestic violence situation is a much longer process. And one of the things that we do that I haven't even mentioned is that we go into the schools and do counseling for kids in the schools that are either have been victims of domestic violence themselves or dating violence or actually child abuse also. We really want to stop the intergenerational nature of the cycle of violence, and so by being able to work with children is one of the ways of being able to do that. We would like to really have a stronger children's program within the shelter. The needs are pretty endless. Yeah, I think people tend to think that domestic violence only happens to poor women, women in a lower socioeconomic group, and that's not true. It can happen to any woman. I know when I first moved to San Luis Obispo, everybody said, well, there can't be any domestic violence there. You're living in paradise. And yes, in many ways it is paradise, but it's like every other place. There is domestic violence.
I am thankful to this shelter in particular, because this is where I got the help. And knowing that we needed Spanish-speaking staff, I wanted to come back one day.
Right.
I wanted to come back and see if I could help other women understand that there is a way out. There is more opportunities, even though there is a lot of obstacles to go over.
Well, we're going to do this.
Now we can assist them with that. We know where there is the help for that person. We can keep on going with counseling because that's what they need the most, so they can feel better about themselves, so they can see that they can get out of something like what they're suffering. They can do it. But first they have to be strong, and they have to understand that there is a way to be strong. If I hadn't have had that break and that place to be able to turn my life around, I don't know if I wouldn't have kept repeating getting involved in losing relationships. Somebody provided everything I needed to be able to live my life, and the other girls that were in there. And from that moment on, I found any way that I could to give back. And I use myself as an example of how I was able to get a new start with that break in my life and that safe place to go. How hopeless women feel that go there. They've lost everything. They're down to nothing. And they need all the support they can, because they can get it back. They can all get it back. They just need some hand up.
They can get out of something like what they're suffering. They can do it.
Our video kind of gives you an overview of what we do and the people we serve in this county. We do serve the entire county. There is North County Women's Shelter Program and Resource, and they kind of handle the Atascadero, kind of above the grade, Paso and Atascadero. But, of course, we work very closely with them. If we have resources they need, and we trade back and forth. We do have a website. It's the womensshelterslo.org. If anybody would like to see information on us, probably if you are in crisis or if you need information for somebody who is in crisis, the best way to get a hold of us is 549-8989, which is the county hotline number, and then they can page the on-call crisis worker. And a lot of times that's a volunteer. They're trained, and we're very grateful to them. Our volunteers, we could not do what we do without our volunteers. And, of course, all the generous donations and everything we've received from San Luis Obispo community. Are there any questions?
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, with methamphetamine and polydrug use, quite often substance abuse is a real issue in the home, and it could be with both parties. And I didn't hear that mentioned in the video or how we're addressing that for the children.
We find that, well, a national study by the Victims of Crime found that about 65% of domestic violence relationships have no drugs or alcohol involved. So about 30-35% have some drug and alcohol issues. We partner with different AA programs if it's alcohol issues. We have seen an alarming rise in the methamphetamines and how it just escalates, really, the situation of domestic violence. Where really alcohol and drugs, other than meth, are kind of a lubricant. We find that even if the person sobers up, there's still domestic violence. It doesn't cure the situation to remove the alcohol or drugs. However, with meth, it does create that violent atmosphere. So we're still kind of looking at it, but we do partner with drug and alcohol and try to get them services. Just because a person comes in who has drug or alcohol issues doesn't mean we turn them away. You know, they still have DV, they're still a victim. I'm sorry, DV is domestic violence. If I throw out acronyms you don't understand, tend to talk like the lingo. So we do partner and serve them. One thing we are finding, too, is victims of domestic violence sometimes are drugged by the batterer. We had a case come in where he was slipping meth into, like, her tea, and so she became addicted to that. And actually, his mother accidentally got her tea one time and ended up high. So, you know, there are different situations, and the batterers do use that. And they do get services from us. Okay. Any other questions?
What is your primary source of funding?
Oh, wow. Domestic violence is such a vast situation. It affects so many different parts of a person's life that we have funding from federal. We get funding from Homeland Security, which is kind of bizarre. But we get funding from the state. We get numerous grants, MCH, OES, different grants. But about 51% of all of our funds come from San Luis Obispo County through fundraisers, through private donors, individuals, in kind. You know, people bring us food or people bring us gas cards or things like that too. So just a wide array.
Any other questions from the commissioners? Thank you very much for being
here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our presentations from the local nonprofits. This would be a good place to take a break if we were going to take one, or we could mush on through and do the rest of our agenda. What is the pleasure of the commissioners? Mush. All right. In that case, then, we'll have Dr. Thomas's Public Health Department report.
Okay. I will mush on. Mush or mush? I'm not sure. Mush. Okay.
Excuse me while I get a water. Then you can mush on.
I have a packet for each of the commissioners. The CHC report to the Board of Supervisors went last week and is stapled to the rest of the report, which Gene nicely put on a Christmas border. Yes. Medi-Cal Managed Care report is going to the Board of Supervisors tomorrow. It is recommending that the county, that the board direct the health agency director and county administrative office to begin the negotiation process for implementation of a county-organized health system with the Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority. So that's the recommendation after managed care Medi-Cal work group reviewed options and went out and did interviews with stakeholders. Update on influenza. Get a lot of calls about influenza. It's the most common call these days to public health, I think. Vaccine has slowly come more and more to the county, we were able to provide CHC with some vaccine, and they're doing some public health clinics as well as some limited public health vaccine through public health by appointment. It appears most of the need has been met, but the distribution system is messed up, and many, many physicians didn't get the influenza vaccine that they ordered. So far, the message is it's December 12th tonight, but it's still not too late to get a flu shot. So if you're in that risk group, it's not too late. Keep looking for a flu shot. Call public health or go to 788-2903, the flu clinic. We have a new name for it. It's called PHIL, the Public Health Information Line, otherwise known as PHIL, 788-2903. We are continuing our work on pandemic flu preparation and recommendations to the county as a whole. There is currently a hiring freeze in the health agency. There are freeze exemption requests available, so we are looking at each position that we have open critically and determining whether we can do with holding that open for a while and hoping that the freeze will thaw. There is a pretty significant mental health budget shortfall, they are working on that at this time. As was reported earlier, the perinatal substance abuse leadership team met last week to further develop plans and budget for a children's center that would assess children who are picked up on of the what's called ASQ, the Ages and Stages Questionnaire, and the Ages and Stages Social and Emotional Screening Test, and refer them for treatment. So that would be done through that can be done by social services caseworkers. It can be done by physicians. It can be done in Head Start programs and preschools, and so to provide a referral to screen and then make a referral for a further assessment and then onward to treatment if needed. And budgets are due February 10th. We don't have all our so-called matrix charges, our overhead charges yet. So our program managers are in the early stages. They can. We have budget projections for staff, which is a significant part of the cost of the services we provide. And so those budget projections for salaries and benefits are being put in the matrices of our new EFS, Enterprise Financial System, so that we can put together a cogent budget proposal. And so it's time to grind up that system of the budget committee and figure out when the best time is to go over where we're going. And that's the end of my report. Any questions? Otherwise, happy Christmas, happy holidays.
I have one question about the flu that may be coming or may not be coming. How prepared is this county? And how imminent does it look that we're going to get it?
I assume you're talking about the avian flu. Avian flu, so-called H5N1, is a subtype that infects only fowl in the normal state, chickens, ducks, turkeys, and is in an expanding number of areas in Asia and Siberia and Uzbekistan
and to Europe,
moving closer and closer to Europe. And the right now, the way the virus is acting, you have to be pretty intimate with a chicken. You have to be very close with the chicken, live in very close quarters to come down with avian flu. And it's bad if you get it, because there's almost, it appears to be, at least given the number of reports, almost a 50% human mortality rate, although it's probably significantly underreported, so the people who get mild cases aren't being reported, and they're only tracking the bad cases. So significant genetic mutation would be required for avian flu to become something that was transmissible human to human. Is it possible that avian flu in its current form will come to the United States via bird migratory patterns?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's certainly possible. It's probably not unreasonable to think it might, given migratory patterns and flyways. Economics and culture of raising turkeys and chickens and ducks in this country are very different than they are in Asia. And so barring a significant mutation in the virus, it's probably less likely that we will have huge poultry flocks affected, but it is certainly possible, and it's certainly being there's a lot of surveillance to pick it up if it does happen. And a lot of work to be done to make sure that if it is in the wild bird stock, it doesn't get into the poultry flocks. Also, people, when they hear this, they freak out and say, oh, God, I'm never going to eat another chicken in my life. It's close contact with a live chicken that's generally what's dangerous. Adequately cooked fowl, I should say, does not pass it on to humans. how well is the county equipped if we had a full pandemic, if there was a significant change in the virus? There's still a lot of work this country needs to do. There's a lot of work this state needs to do. There's more work that the county needs to do. Our first line of defense is to say, if it happens to change and become human-to-human transmission, it could happen anywhere. We need to be looking for it everywhere in the world. So if it does, we have a chance of controlling that shift in the virus. And so we certainly have our eyes open, and if we had unusual patterns, we would be doing, we know how to do the testing to find out if we have a unusual flu virus in a human. That being said, what are the chances of that happening in San Luis Obispo County, this one spot in the whole world? Probably pretty small, but we'll be looking for it as they are everywhere in California. If we have a full-fledged pandemic, then rapid flu vaccine development is a technology that is being worked on. It's slowly, and the process right now is to use chicken embryos, and that is a process that, as we see in every annual flu vaccine production, takes 6 months to do once you've developed the vaccine. So unless they use genetic engineering techniques to speed up that process and thereby have a process that would save lives, that they're working on that process. Short of that, we are doing the kinds of things that there are antiviral medications that hope they are trying to step up production. And no, we don't have a big stockpile of Tamiflu in this county at this time. And there's a shortage of it, and it probably makes more sense to stockpile the stuff regionally so that if you need to use it to stamp out a outbreak, you can. The next kinds of things, if we were in a full pandemic, to think about it as a bad flu year times 10 or 20. In an average year, we have 36,000-40,000 people in the country die of flu vaccine of influenza, and so we easily could be talking 10 to 20 times that, and we would be doing the kind of public health education about how to protect yourself, how to protect workers when they're working, and how to assist hospitals increase their surge capacity. Stuff that is hard on a hospital because they're sometimes in a normal flu season at peak capacity. So these are all things, legal things that we need to do. We're working with county council on, and at a statewide level they're working. If there was a horrible flu pandemic, we would increase social isolation so that we would, if it was the worst pandemic you can imagine, we would do what they did in 1918. We would close schools. We would close theaters. We would close the swimming pool, which would really bum me out. We would do a lot of things that are almost unthinkable. But if we had to do them to save lives, we would do them. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. Makes me more.
Now, I want to say, Commissioner Horn, that these are things that probably ought to keep me awake at night, but as they say, just like with bioterrorism preparedness, the effects of not being prepared are astronomical. On the other hand, the possibility of this gene shift so that it is human-to-human transmissible, we don't know what that probability is, except that it in any given year, it's probably pretty darn small.
Thank you.
But I could go on for another hour if you want.
Thank you for that short dissertation. Are there any other questions for Dr. Thomas? Then we'll move on to the commission updates. The chair has no update. I think we'll start to my left. Commissioner Pinkel?
Not today.
Commissioner O'Dell?
Yes, and the Mental Health Services Act, you recall, was passed a year ago, November, and each county was asked to develop a plan. Well, this plan has finally been developed and approved by the Mental Health Board last Thursday, and it's targeted to go to the Board of Supervisors on December 20th. Is that still on? And then go to the state on the 22nd. And there's a deadline to get it in by the 31st. Otherwise, we get more delays from the state. So the county will be getting it in that deadline time. And if things go well, there should be funds coming from maybe starting in April, possibly. I would be a little more pessimistic in that, but that's what is thought might happen. And these are new funds that have to be used for new programs. They cannot supplant other funds. They cannot supplant other funds, and so that these will be funds monitored throughout every year by the state as separate funds, separate programs, and the results there of those programs will be monitored. And it's an entirely different system that's going on right now.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board reviewed their budget for 05-06 and looking at how the department had been spending the various monies that come from the state and federal government for treatment and in preparation for the budget process that's coming up.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Massey?
Nothing to report.
Commissioner Hale? Commissioner Horn?
Yes, I went to Children's Services Network last week and listened to Dr. Chasnoff, who was talked about earlier by one of the people who was here for a nonprofit. He had some very interesting statistics that talked about the difference when you're drug and alcohol, when you have had drug and alcohol during your pregnancy, as to whether the inattention deficit disorder that their attention deficit disorder that so many children come up with, some of that gets worse, and there's talk about the difference between the biological, that which you get from having the drug and alcohol, versus environmental, because a lot of these children end up in the foster care system, and they don't stay very long with a foster parent. They move from place to place to place, and that becomes a question of whether the child is getting worse because of biologic or whether they're getting worse because of environmental. And so I thought the statistics were very interesting. They're not available until he publishes, and so you got what you got when you were there, and that was it. But very interesting, and I think we'll see some changes in the foster care system as time goes on. That's all.
Thank you. Commissioner Hetherington?
Although I'm unable to attend the SLOCAP meetings, I did have Jean copy a handout about second violence prevention curriculum and a membership form to SLOCAP.
Commissioner Shimosis.
I was able to attend two Adult Services Policy Council meetings. The one in November focused on disaster training, as Karen had mentioned. It's a multi-agency training that it's actually quite a large council, and I think most of the nonprofit community services agencies have reps on that board or on that council. It's very extensive training. They are all partnering in developing mutual support networks to reach the folks, to help identify as well as reach the folks that may be missed in the event of some huge disaster, like what happened for Katrina. It was quite interesting and very extensive. I was very impressed. The December meeting primarily focused on Jess Montoya's presentation, CHC, and some of which I missed because there was an organic farming seminar in the same building, and I got sidetracked. I apologize. It was quite interesting. And the DV task force was over the hill. The meeting was held over the hill, and I could not make that one this month. But that's it.
Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Thomas?
Yes, there's something I was meaning to put in my report, and I got talking about flu, which, and that is that the Paso Robles Smile Survey is in your packet, an oral assessment of kindergarten and third grade children in Paso Robles, California, October 2005. We heard a presentation from the Tolosa Dental Clinic. It's a good thing that it's up there. It says, among other things, key findings, the majority of third grade children in Paso do not have access to dental sealant, a proven method for preventing dental decay. There's a very nice graph on page 5, percentage of children with a history of dental decay, and 51.2% in kindergarten and 66% in third grade. And it notes for the third grade children, the dental decay, this disease was 6 times higher than the prevalence of the next common chronic disease of childhood, asthma, 11%. 6 times more children have this than have asthma, which is a pretty common condition. So it's good reading, it's available from our office. If somebody would like a copy, you can send them an electronic copy.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. All right. How about committee reports? The Legislative Committee? Commissioner Horn, you were looking at me like you had something you wanted to say.
I did want to point out one thing for the public out there, and that's the book that I gave out to everybody here. It's called Know Your County, and it is available in a number of places throughout the county, and it's an information booklet about all about the county and county government.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did I hear anything from the Legislative Committee?
We haven't met yet.
Thank you. Nominating Committee?
We had a report.
No report from the Nominating Committee. Community Education Committee?
A report, but I look forward to meeting in January. I have a list of ideas for Public Health Week.
Good.
Great, thank you. And the Budget Committee has not met.
No, but I'm assuming that Dr. Thomas will set up a meeting in January, sometime in January.
All right. The last item on the agenda is to talk about our prospective future items. When we made our plan earlier this year, we talked about January. We were going to address the Veterans Hospital Care and TRICARE. We wanted to have that on the agenda. Was there anything else that anybody wanted to have us theme around in January?
I don't know whether there's been a discussion of the biosolids review of the existing ordinance. I think it's set to sunset in 2 or 3 months later, and so a review of the history of the ordinance, where we're at this point, would be January would be about the appropriate time for that.
Commissioner Hetherington, the biosolids committee does still exist. You and I are on it, I guess.
So nice and quiet. Dr. Thomas, could you make sure that all of the commissioners get a copy of what the ordinance is right now, the interim ordinance, so that we can have a
intelligent conversation about sludge.
Do we want to invite? Yes.
Batson.
Yes. Yeah. So we'll do that. Any other suggestions or desires for January? Okay. Stay tuned. Commissioner Hetherington.
You might just want to make a note on your master list for February to follow up on those ag testing, water testing. Thank you.
Okay, we'll do that. And we'd also talked about maybe having a bioterrorism overview in February, so we would need to talk with the members of that committee in sometime next month about what kind of presentation they might want to make, what preparedness do we have in the event of a bioterrorist attack. Yes, Commissioner Hetherington.
Will the ombudsperson be here at all of our meetings, or Ms. Miller? Okay, thank you. I'm following up on a call I received.
Wonderful. We'll look forward to seeing you every meeting. I believe that we are finished with the meeting for December and for 2005 of the Health Commission. This meeting is now adjourned.
Well, of course, I didn't bring any of my task force stuff, but I have it.